Good morning. I'd like to bring this meeting of House Education to order. It is about 8:05 on Friday the 13th. Good day for testimony. And President, Representative Keller, Representative Book, Representative Gardner, Representative Edgman, myself, Chair Seaton. I'd like to remind people of their cell phones and also to make sure that we address comments through the chair so that we get names on the record of who's talking. Today we will hear presentations from the Department of Education and Early Development on special education and intensive needs programs. Those will take up probably the majority of time, and then we will continue our discussion on HB 69, early childhood education, rating and home visits. And to make sure that everybody's aware, there should be another, some more materials. The complete McDowell study will be, if it's not out on your desk now, it will be during that time. Are there any questions before we proceed? Mr. Jeans, are you ready? And we have been joined by Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. Today with me is Cindy Curran, who's the Director of the Teaching and Learning Support, and she actually supervises our special education division or section. And so Cindy's going to give you a brief overview of the what the special ed team does for the department, for the school districts, and then we do have some information that that Louie distributed to you that we'll go through. Some of it is to cover the special ed presentation. Some of it is questions that you've asked in previous meetings about special education. We actually got all the information together for you.
Great.
So I'm going to turn it over to Cindy, and then I'll be right back here.
And before we proceed, I wanted to recognize that Representative Wilson has joined us at the beginning of the meeting here.
Good morning.
And Cindy, would you identify yourself?
I'm Cindy Curran, and I am the Director for Teaching and Learning Support. Our special ed unit is a unit of 11 people. Four of those are program managers who are responsible for the day-to-day running of the special education program. And this unit operates under the federal statutes and the state statutes regarding students with learning disabilities and special needs. And so as they operate under those statutes and regulations, they provide technical assistance to districts. They provide technical assistance to our staff in the department. And the technical assistance could be to superintendents or to principals or to staff members within a building, the teachers. They're responsible for distributing grant funds that come through special education. They help develop with the teacher preparation institutions pre-service programs for special education if there is a working program that's going on, and right now we're in discussions to make sure that we can have that happen. They provide lots of in-service training throughout conferences, going to different districts when they're asked to provide specialized services. They also do complaint investigations, mediations, due process hearings, and compliance reviews. The special ed unit monitors districts on a five-year cycle for their compliance for federal and state regulations. They conduct meetings, work sessions, and conferences, as I said before. And they are responsible for ensuring that children receive early screening and intervention for health and developmental learning needs. They also collaborate with other agencies that have work with children, such as the Health Department of Health and Social Services. And they work together to provide services and support. And in health, it would be general, oral, mental, and behavioral health. Part C and the early intervention services, Head Start and daycare services. special ed unit. The funding also supports the Autism Resource Center, supports the Secondary Transition Services, which you heard about recently, I believe, and helps support the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation Activities. Within the University of Alaska statewide system, the Alaska Teacher Placement Center has worked with the special ed unit in a special education professional development grant in order to create more special ed teachers and mentor special ed teachers in their first 2 years in the state of Alaska.
Cindy, yeah. Is that mentoring different than the teacher mentoring program? Is this a mentoring for every special ed teacher coming into the state of Alaska? Is that what I understood?
Chair Seaton, within the framework of the statewide mentor project, the special ed development grant paid for special education mentors to mentor the new special education teachers in our state so that they would know what the requirements were in our state and help them through the way we do IEPs and other paperwork and provide services within the state.
Okay, and Cindy, is that an ongoing program or does that require funding through the mentor program? What I'm trying to do is find out the parameters of this program, whether it's an ongoing program or it's something that policy needs to be promoted to have that continue.
Chair Seaton, the Special Ed Professional Development Grant has one more year to run. It was a federal grant that the department applied for and received. I don't know if that is a grant that we can apply for again, whether OSEP, the Office of Special Education Programs, through the federal government, is doing that grant competition again.
Okay, and I'd just like to flag for you and Eddie, and mm-hmm. at some time what we'd like to do is get a analysis of what the department believes the results of that mentoring is, or how important that is for special ed teachers coming into the state. Also, whether the grant can be applied for again. But as far as on the mm-hmm. scale of 1 to 10, where is that piece of special education mm-hmm. Teacher training? Thank you. We have two more questions. Representative Wilson and Gardner.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I actually have four different questions, and if you prefer to wait till the end of it, I can do that.
Is it?
On specifically what she's already talked about.
Cindy, are you ready? Let's go ahead. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. You said pre-service programs, if available. Did you mean pre-kindergarten service?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, preparing special education teachers for our state. Currently, we have an early childhood special education program uh-huh. that operates out of the University of Alaska Anchorage, and the University of Alaska Southeast has a special education teacher preparation program for teachers who already have teacher preparation, who are already teachers. It's an endorsement program. Currently in our state, we don't have a four-year program leading to right. special education.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. That's another question.
Okay.
You mentioned about the responsibility for complaints investigations, and it kind of struck me. I have a lot of parents have come to me unhappy about the services their kids are getting in my district. And so I've paid some fair attention to this. And at the same time, when I talked to Superintendent Como mm-hmm. just this week, she talked about how there are a very few parents whose complaints are really burdensome. And what they want is just not possible. Do we have a mechanism for dealing with the actual cost of that type of complaint? That's just sort of ongoing, one thing after another, and they have hearings and mediation and.
Representative Gardner, I just checked with Eddie, and no, we do not have that mechanism. We do understand what Superintendent Como has said. Parents of children are afforded due process, and every complaint is investigated. Because it has to be. Mm-hmm.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I know that there's legislation in this body dealing with the issue of complaints against troopers. Mm-hmm. There's been legislation, or actually pending, dealing with complaints by psychiatric patients about rights violations, and you know, I certainly understand this, and somehow it seems that people ought to have a way to make their views known, to ask for assistance, and at the same time, in every category, there are some people who will just, you know, burden the system with a whole series of.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, there are agencies that are available to parents, like the Disability Law Center. Mm-hmm. So if their complaints, if they're not being satisfied in the complaint process, they can always go to Disability Law Center and get assistance through that mechanism. So I think what you're probably hearing from Superintendent Como is the cost to go through the entire process of some of these complaints. And, you know, some of them are very burdensome. But it's the district's responsibility to provide the educational services. Mm-hmm. And that's where the complaint comes from, is the parent believes that their child is entitled to additional services that the district may believe is unreasonable. And so they have to go through this process to reconcile that.
And at the same time.
Yeah, and Representative Gardner, and for the record, that was Eddie James. Uh-huh. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. And at the same time, some of the parents might be right, that the kids are not getting what they need.
That, through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's absolutely correct. And then the hearing officer or administrative law judge will issue an order, and the district has to comply.
Thank you.
Further question, Representative Gardner.
Yes. I see on this sheet about you, and you mentioned the Autism Resource Center. Mm-hmm. And according to the numbers on the handout, the autism diagnostics, at least the identified kids, is slightly over a third of the LD general a tenth of the LD general population, and yet we have a resource center specifically for one-tenth of this population. And I also noticed, in light of the fact that the governor has wanted to make autism kind of a focus this year and autism diagnostics, and yet, it just surprises me when we know that we lead the nation in fetal alcohol, even though I hear the rates there are dropping, and we've had some effectiveness. And I guess I don't know why we have a specific center for a category that's one-tenth of a much bigger category of need.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, what's the other category you're referring to?
Learning? Just LD, learning disabled, and learning I assume disabled. That includes dyslexia.
Sure.
And whatever.
Well, through the chair, Representative Gardner, that category includes a lot of things. In fact, my own children are ADD, mm-hmm. and they fall into that category. But the level of services that they require through their IEP are very minimal. But we can't get those services without them being identified as a child with disability. I think it's quite a bit different than what you would find in for the children that are identified as autistic.
Okay. So it's just a more intense need.
Yes.
Through the chair.
Okay. Representative Gardner?
Finally, last question that I have right now is about early screening. And I know that pediatricians can make referrals if there's parent can bring a child in for an assessment or whatever, but given that we have another bill that relates pretty clearly to this House Bill 69 I'm referring to help kind of identify special needs kids, is there any kind of outreach through the Department of Education? I mean, if you don't have a parent who's knowledgeable enough to say something might be wrong here, mm-hmm. how do we reach those children to know if they need early services?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, Child Find, every district has people who are tasked with helping parents identify young children that are in need of services. And many districts hold parent meetings. I've seen advertisements in the Anchorage Daily News for Child Find services for both Anchorage and MATSU. Districts are the ones that do the outreach for Child Find. It's something that is done to help parents who may not be as aware as other parents that their children need some help.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson, then Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Cindy, one of the I realize that the parents are afforded complete due process whenever something comes up, and then depending on what the outcome is, the school acts accordingly. But you know what? I think I forgot what I was going to ask.
You want to pass? And
No. I know what it was. I know what it was. Sorry. You said that the teachers, the special ed teachers that are coming into Alaska from somewhere else, get this training. And a lot of the rules and regulations, most of them, I think, are federal. Mm-hmm. And is Alaska that much different from other states, or is it just that we just handle it a little bit different? Or
through the chair, Representative Wilson, when you consider that the people that are being mentored our first and second year teachers, they don't have the experience necessarily with IEPs and running meetings and those kinds of things, and that's what the mentoring does for them.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the collaboration with other agencies, you know, you mentioned health. Could you give me some specifics? I know there are some, but I just try to kind of give you a better picture, a comprehensive of the specifics of how you work with health and social services. I mean, is there a task force? Or, how do you collaborate? How does it actually work?
Through the chair, Representative Keller. I would say program managers from both departments work on areas that are specific to the special education and the health and early intervention services. So yes, there could be a task force. It could be that there's a need and they come together to figure out what a solution might be. There are councils of folks that come together. What's the name of that? I apologize.
No.
My brain just went zits. I'll get back to you with a name, but there is a group of people that meet together. I am so sorry. On a regular basis, too.
Representative Keller.
Don't feel bad. I can really relate to that. very easy to do. The next one is leading question that it just give you an opportunity to talk about a little bit, and it helps me understand. It took me a while to understand. The department administers, you know, like you've got here in your presentation, provides resources to districts, and there's a lot in here, like four or five of the bullets talk about compliance, you know, with federal and state regulations and laws. And but the department really doesn't do a lot in the area of innovation, in the area of actually quality control or doing things to ensure the end product that in our state, as I understand it, is left up to the districts, the burning heart of the districts. And am I understanding this correctly, that that's, we don't have like a division of innovation or anything like that within the department?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, are you referencing special education or just innovation in general?
Just in general. And the reason I asked the question is just as you were going through the role here, mm-hmm. Of what, how you work with special ed, I was trying to parallel in my mind how that's going to work with the early education role that I think you're being asked to take on in another bill. And so that's why the connection here on the question.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, as all of the people who work in the department that are responsible for different programs go to various professional development opportunities for themselves and learn about the variety of things that are going on throughout the United States, they bring that knowledge back to the state of Alaska. Two examples that come to mind are response to intervention, which we call response to instruction in our state, and positive behavioral supports. And these are things that have been going on in other states, and we have gone out to learn about them so that we can use them in the state of Alaska and help with the end product of having students who have student achievement levels that we want them to have. Is that what you're referring to?
Representative Keller.
I think it's a rabbit trail, and I don't want to take the committee's time. So, but and by the way, the same thing almost happened to me that happened to you when you. So, thank you,
Mr. Jean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to comment on that question, Representative Keller. I know this isn't the budget committee, but you are the policy committee, and I know a few of you sit on the budget committee. And this is exactly what I've been trying to point out to the subcommittee for a number of years. The teaching and learning division is that student and assessment section in our budget with 70 employees. Those 70 employees basically are funded through federal programs. And their job is to make sure that school districts are complying with the federal grants that they're receiving. So when you're asking, do we have a division of innovation or a section, the answer is no. And that needs to come from state funding, if that's what the legislature desires. But these people are implementing the federal laws, not our own. Well, they help a little bit with our state laws, but I mean, most of this, especially in special education or children with disabilities, is dictated by the federal mandates.
Good. Eddie, I wanted to, or Cindy, I wanted to back up. You know, we're talking about the department's overseeing and how you help. Would you go back through, and I know everyone's different, but I think for the committee and the listening public, we need to know basically what is special education, what is the qualification to get special education, how are individual education plans done? What, you know, so that we're going to in a little bit talk about intensive needs, and we need to know where the parameters are for special ed before we go on to talk about a slightly separate division of that.
Chair Seaton, I was a teacher for a very long time, and I will speak to this from knowing what happens when you have a child in a classroom who is not achieving at a level that you would think a child at that particular age would be attaining. And it could be a behavior, it could be not being able to read, could be a physical not being able to do something. And so as a teacher, there are things that you do to intervene to try to help the student, and you work with a special ed teacher, and these are students who have special needs, and you, as you're working with the special ed teacher before you even take the child's name anywhere, they're suggesting things. There are lots of books to look at for ways that you can try to help the child achieve what he or she should be doing. After that process has not worked, then typically you go and take the student's name and all of the data that you've collected about what you've done and what the child's response to what you've done is, and you are there with an IEP team, and it consists of, that's the individual education plan team. It can consist of the principal, the principal, the classroom teacher, the special education teacher. Many times there can be a child parent advocate. The school psychologist would be there. And you're taking and laying everything out for that team to take a look at. From there, the team decides whether or not the child would get an evaluation by a school psychologist or a school psychometrist.
Okay. Let us break there. Representative Wilson, you had a point.
I just want, if you can tell the committee, you left out a part that, like, so do you, how do you contact the parent or to let them know that there's a problem before that, you know what I'm saying? So they know kind of the steps that you go through.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, as you're working with the student, you're talking to the parent and letting them know that the child is not meeting the standards that one would expect. And you're letting the parent know, this is what I'm doing to try to help the student do better, achieve well. And I forgot to mention that the parent is at the IEP team meeting also. So there's a group of people there, and all the data's laid out. And at that point in time, the team decides whether or not the child needs an evaluation. So the evaluation is done, it's scored, it comes back, the IEP team meets again to determine what types of services the student would need. And there's a whole range of services that can happen for a student with learning disabilities. They could be pulled out to work on their mathematics. If it's a physical therapy thing, there many schools have, if they don't have one within the district, they contract with someone who comes to all of their sites to provide the child with service and then someone in the building to help that child in the meantime. Then the IEPs are reviewed at a periodic basis to make sure that the things are proceeding the way they're supposed to, and the same team comes back to look at the data that's collected once the services are being provided.
Okay, so Cindy, just to clarify, so that the classroom teacher would often be the person that has been working with a child, someone who is seen to be underperforming, and for whatever reason, mm-hmm. There'd be parent conferences probably with the teacher as there normally are. Then if the student is still not progressing and before you've identified why,
right,
you just know that the student is not progressing, then at some point, is there either stimulated by the parent's request or the teacher's request, what has to happen to get to that meeting to develop an IEP or to classify as special education? Where's that boundary where it kicks over into special ed so that those services can be accessed?
Chair Seaton, if a parent comes to a teacher and says, I believe that my child has a problem, the classroom teacher at that point would be all eyes and ears to see what it is that the parent's concerns are, and then try to work with the parent. Sometimes it's let's say it's a speech impediment, that could be fairly obvious. So that is not something that a classroom teacher can truly intervene in. There are certain things that you can do, but those kinds of things would move to at the parent's request, teacher's request, to the IEP team for the evaluation by the speech pathologist so that the correct services could be provided.
So that can, that request can be either by the teacher identifying the needs mm-hmm. or the parents identifying the needs, either way?
Chair Seaton, that is correct.
Okay. Mr. Jeans?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, what happens is either the teacher or the parents can come to the principal and ask for an evaluation, and you meet with the teacher, the principal, you express your concerns, and then they will do an evaluation to determine whether or not your child's eligible for services. And then once that evaluation has been made and the determination has been made that they're eligible, then you move to the next step of convening the group and developing the IEP.
Okay, good. I want to make sure that we all have the same basic understanding of how this all progresses. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. If a parent resists having their child identified with an IEP, Can the district continue to try to establish it without the parental okay, or do you need parental consent to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I would have to find out a for sure and certain answer. I've seen it in my own personal experience that the student is provided services, but if a parent truly doesn't want services provided, that is their right.
And then,
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. It, as a child then progresses, is it fairly easy to then remove an IEP if they've progressed to a level that allows that to happen, or is it once that you're in the system that are identified that stays with you throughout your K-12 experience?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, the purpose of an IEP is to help the student come up as far as the student can. There are certain things that after so many interventions and you go back with the data, you look at it, and it's determined that the child can exit special education. That is done. Some children are in special education throughout their careers. Others have the interventions. They get the services. The IEP team meets again. The parents meet with everyone, and they're exited from special education.
Okay, Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we also get some sort of estimated number of how many parents actually turn down this opportunity or the chance to have the IEP engage and so forth? Because my son went through an IEP process, and so I'm somewhat familiar with it. But I'm sitting here guessing that it's probably a fairly small percent of the overall. So it would really be helpful to me to know just exactly what that number might be. Is it less than 10%, less than 5%, or something like that? Because I'm sitting here guessing it's probably a pretty small percent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Jeans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edgman, we'll try and get that information for you. I don't think that we actually collect that information at the department, and I guess as far as parents not wanting the special education services, I mean, if it's like if a child has trouble with reading and so they're identified as not dyslexic but a learning disability, it may be that a recommendation would be remove them from the class so that they can read independently or with a buddy, but in another room so it's real quiet and all that, and the parent doesn't want that. But the teacher may still take that child and set them in a different part of the room so that they have, some privacy while they're reading. So, I just can't really imagine that there's a lot of parents out there that says, I don't want this level of service, because I mean it really is specialized instruction is what they're getting, and they're getting it in a contract. So
Cindy, did you have something to add on that? Or,
Chair Seaton, no.
Did you have a follow-up? Representative Keller and then Gardner.
If I could, just a quick comment. in the education committee here in the state, which I've listened to countless hearings on, I've never seen a parent that wasn't interested in keeping an individual learning plan for their own student. That's anecdotal. I have no data, but I've never heard that in testimony here. It may have happened, but I missed it. It's for interest.
Reverend Gardner.
Thank you. I think that part of the concern about people who might decline an IEP may be if people think that it comes with a label. But am I accurate in believing that a child doesn't have to have a diagnosis to get an IEP? It doesn't mean this child's learning disabled or something because they have an IEP. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the labeling piece is not the the important part. It's what disability is it that the child has? How can we help that child? And in my experience, it may be a label on a piece of paper, but it's not, it doesn't follow that child around to different classroom teachers. This child needs help with reading, so this child gets X amount of services. This child has trouble with physical, needs physical therapy. So it's just the child goes and gets the help that the child needs. You don't say little Johnny is learning disabled or not physically able to do things. That's not the way teachers refer to that in a school. Is that what you're asking about?
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, actually, my kids have had several IEPs, sometimes brought up by the teachers and sometimes at my request that they be tested for different things. And I know that, well, I'm not aware that it came with a label, and I think that's sort of the root of Representative Munoz's question. You know, one of my kids had speech therapy for 6 years. Did that mean that he had a label that somehow said he had a disability? I don't know. I don't think so. But he sure had a speech problem.
Representative Wilson.
There is one thing that I think that kids or parents may at times have a problem with, and that's if they have ADDA, and sometimes the school will suggest a way that maybe that would help, and sometimes they don't want to give them have their child take the medication, so then they have to go other avenues. I mean, I'm sure that happens quite often, and I'm trying to think of different situations that the parent wouldn't want it, and sometimes that happens. And that's the only one I can think of that, you know, and it's just a different thought process, I think, that what the parents believe versus what somebody else believes, I would imagine. But, and I don't know how often that happens, but.
And I presume, from what I'm understanding, that would be the discussion that would take place in the development of the IEP, individual education plan, and whatever. I mean, the team has to decide, including the parent, has to decide on a course that's going of services that will augment that that student's advancement or potential advancement in school. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to go back to my own experience. One of my children was identified as ADD. We took her to our family doctor, and they confirmed she's ADD. They recommended medication for her, and her mother and I decided to put her on that medication. We could have elected not to put her on that medication, but she's still ADD, and she was still eligible for the special education services with or without the medicine. So the medicine isn't going to trigger whether or not the child gets the services. It's the disability. And I'm happy to say that my daughter doesn't take her medication anymore, that she's learned to work through it. That took like 3 years. And that medication that she was on was mind-altering medication. But she's a good student now. She's very focused. She knows what she has to do to remain focused. But that was all part of the learning process with the individualized instruction she received from the school district.
Was there a question over? Okay.
If we're done, I would just like to say, what's that bright light?
We were here the other day, and somebody volunteered to shut the blinds, and everybody said, no!
No.
It's fine. Cindy, had you wrapped up, or had we interrupted you at a point, or can you go ahead and remember where we were?
Chair Seaton, members of the committee, the special ed unit also assists and supports the alternative assessment. As I said before, response to intervention initiatives, positive behavioral supports, working with McKinney Bento on the homeless students need to be provided special education services if they qualify, and working with correspondents and homeschool initiatives also. There's federal funding that's provided for preschool handicapped children from ages 3 to 5. And I mentioned previously the special ed personnel development grant. And as you can imagine, special education is very, very deep. And on the state webpage, the department's webpage, is a guidance document called the Special Education Handbook. And when you open that up, that's why it's not printed, that's why it's on that webpage. You can go in and you can find the federal regulations. You can find examples of IEPs. You can find everything that you need to know about special education. And that is reviewed yearly and updated as necessary if new federal regulations come along, and throw in that IDEA is up for reauthorization in 2009. Once again, we don't know whether that's going to happen or not. The Special Education Handbook, every year there is a special education special ed directors conference, and at that conference, new special ed directors are introduced to the handbook and how to use it so that the needs of students are met and due process is followed, and we don't run into some of the issues that you've probably heard about through the years. And I'm going to turn it over to Eddie for intensive needs.
Okay, before we go there, about what percentage or proportion of students going through our K-12 system have individual education plans for because of special needs?
Mr. Chairman, we have approximately 17,660 students on identified as special education. We have about 128,000 students statewide.
So a little over 10, so over 10%, 12, something like that. Okay. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Under special needs funding is also vocational programming, and I'm wondering how do you determine funding for a district based on the vocational component?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, that on this sheet specifically references vocational rehabilitation, and our department special ed folks work with them, and there is funding that goes through the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation for programs.
Okay. So, excuse me. So we're not talking about vocational technical education. We're talking about rehabilitative.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, that is correct.
Thank you.
And Cindy, could you explain kind of what kind of thing we would have in K-12 with vocational rehabilitation services? I'm just asking what that would be. Examples, if you have it. If you don't, you can send it to us later, and we're just trying to figure out the parameters here.
Through the chair, Chair Seaton, I will have to find out, but vocational rehabilitation would be with a secondary transition and students needing more specialized services to be rehabilitated, physical impairments. I will get more information on that for you.
And that would be fine, thanks. Mm-hmm. Representative Book, and then Gardner.
Through the chair, thank you. Regarding Representative Munoz's point, I think it is important to point out that vocational education is under the block granting concept that we have in that as well. So we're not only talking about vocational rehab, we're talking about vocational education being lumped into the same group. Is that not true?
Through the chair, Representative Book, you're correct.
James, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're correct. The vocational education for the K-12 system is included in the 20% block grant. The vocational rehabilitation that Cindy is referring to is those transitional services that a child needs, which is no longer really a child. It's when they're 21 and they're leaving the K-12 system and they need assistance to transition into adulthood and providing for themselves, that kind of thing. And that's where the vocational work with Division of Vocational Rehab comes in.
Okay, Cindy, that's probably enough. I just was trying to figure out where in K-12 vocational rehabilitation, but it's transition out of school where there is a special need to make sure that they can function in independently in society. Representative Gardner, and then Wilson.
Thank you. Through the chair, do you know what, either one of you know what the national average of identified special ed kids is, the national average? And then if I've done the numbers correctly here on our math, we have about 7.25% of kids identified.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I don't have that information with me. I could find out for you.
Thank you. And through the chair, I mean, is it reasonable to anticipate that we should be identifying slightly higher than the national average here in Alaska, given our substance abuse problems, the domestic violence, the sexual assault on children, and the emotional problems that lead to learning issues?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I honestly don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I kind of want to piggyback a little bit on what Representative Munoz said. If I understand it right, but I might not have it right in my mind, but the funding for vocational or vo-tech programs actually is in the 20% that special ed is in, is it so that if we have technical vocational type things for kids to take a different path than college, that money for the schools has to come out of that same group of money that the special ed, or am I wrong?
Mr. Jean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Wilson. The 20% block funding is called special needs. It's to assist school districts in providing special education, bilingual, bicultural, and vocational education. The districts, once they've identified a child in special education, develop an IEP, whatever the costs are, they have to provide the services. I don't want to say that the 20% is intended to cover all of those categories.
But
it's to assist the districts. Districts can use some of their general operating funds to support their vocational programs. So to say that the 20% is all a district gets to address special education, bilingual, bicultural, vocational, and gifted, talented, it's a way to allocate resources. And it's discretionary money, just like the regular kid count money is discretionary. And it's up to the school board to figure out how to provide what services with the total pot of money that they receive.
But I just want to follow up.
Representative Wilson.
But that is the category. I mean, that's the state doesn't say, oh, well, this school has more kids that want to go to technical training rather than school, so we're going to give, or rather than college, so we're going to give them more because they need more vo-tech. That it doesn't happen. Every school gets the same amount in the same category, and that is our slot in with this group of kids that we're talking about here.
Through the chair,
Mr. Jean.
I'm not quite there yet, but maybe someday. Representative Wilson, the 20% block money is, you are correct. That is what they get. I will not say that they all get the same amount. They all get the 20% block. So, because you have to consider the school size adjustment, geographic cost differential,
yeah,
before the 20% is added on. So to say that everybody gets the same amount for 20% isn't really accurate. But that is the mechanism in our funding formula.
Yeah.
And I think if you could hold on to that, I think when we get to some of the schedules here in a minute, you'll see how the funding is being increased under the current funding formula for special needs and intensive needs as a group. Okay?
Okay. And Mr. Jeans, just for clarity, if we didn't allocate a 20% block grant, which we could do, I mean, that's just something we're that's in the formula that we've decided to do it. The school districts would still be required to provide special education and whatever other facilities, whatever other services through the money that we allocated. In other words, we've developed the formula, and at one time the legislature said, gee, through the formula, we don't have enough for these extra, so we're going to give an additional block to take care of some extra services, but it's not that those services, whether it's voc ed or special ed, comes out of that limited pot, and that provides it, because the services they're going to provide are going to be determined by the school district's choices, whether they want to have more teachers in the classroom or whether they want to have more voc ed or whether they want to have, I mean, I just want to
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct.
Okay, thanks. Representative Booth.
Dovetailing with exactly what you're saying, Mr. Chairman, just clarifying, in no other component of the funding is vocational education mentioned.
Through the chair, Representative Book, you're correct.
Thank you.
Did we, Representative Keller?
forgive me for throwing this in, but it's a really good point. It's the same thing with charter schools. You know, there's no, the funding is, it's left up to the district to, you know, to make, to sort that out. I mean, there's no mandate from us as far as what portion of that goes, as I understand it, toward the charter schools.
Mr. Jean, did you have a comment?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, the charter schools is a little bit different in that if there's over 150 students, we can calculate how much the charter school generates, and under the charter school legislation, the district has to give them that base amount at a minimum. And I know that in some of your discussions, we've talked about the additional local contribution, but the statute is very clear. At a minimum, they get the base amount. So.
But I didn't even ask, but I should have. Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks very much, and appreciate this update on special education. I think it's increased all our understanding. At least we all have the same understanding. So, intensive needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've distributed a number of pieces of paper here for you to review. The first thing I wanted to point out is if you take a look at the special education child count by district, you won't see intensive on there anywhere. And that's because these are the federal definitions of disabilities, okay? The reason I bring that up is intensive needs is a state of Alaska term. It's not in the federal law, it's our term. And the state recognizes that some school districts have some children that are extremely high costs to serve. And so we've put the term intensive needs on there. Under the funding formula for the in the foundation program, the legislature just changed the funding for intensive needs students from 5 times the base student allocation to 9 times this year. Next year it goes to 11 times, and the following year it will be 13 times. We're taking the funding for an intensive needs child from approximately $24,000 at the 5 times the base student allocation to almost $75,000 per child by the time it's fully implemented. And, you know, that's a pretty substantial increase. So we want to make sure that districts are making valid claims for their intensive needs students. About 10 years ago, we only had about 1,400 intensive needs students statewide. We're approaching 2,000 this year. So in a 10-year period, we've seen almost a 600 student increase in this particular category, while our overall state population has stayed kind of stagnant. It's been 130,000 to 128 currently. So as we move forward with this intensive needs funding, the department's been doing reviews of school district claims, and we've been getting into quite a few disputes, to put it lightly. So this year, the department did develop training materials for determining eligibility of intensive needs students. We distributed this at the Special Ed Directors Conference and actually provided a training session in this particular area. And so this guide here actually has the regulations. And on you'll see on page 2 is the actual regulation that identifies an intensive needs student. Starting on page 4, we actually take the regulation down and we break it down section by section and give additional clarification of how the department interprets that particular section of regulation. And we've taken it another step, and we've put in our guidance here where we expect to find that information in the IEP. So what we put together here is a step-by-step process for determining eligibility for intensive needs and where to document that need. And so I'm really happy with the work that the department's done on this manual. Actually, I'm not supposed to call it a manual. It's training materials. But it provides all the guidance that the school districts should need. And as we do more reviews and we have more examples, our intent is to incorporate more examples in the different categories as we move forward. Mr. Chairman, I know I'm not supposed to talk about budget, but I'm going to bring it up again if you allow me a little latitude. In our budget, we have a request for $150,000 to provide for auditors for intensive needs funding. That would allow us to hire 3 people on a contractual basis annually to look at every claim, all 2,000 claims, to make sure that they're valid claims. So that's what that piece in our budget is for. In the other materials that we handed out, this one that was paperclip together. Behind there, you'll see special needs funding from fiscal year 06 through 010. And this is the part that I was referring to, Representative Wilson, that you'll see that there's an increase when you combine special needs, the 20% block, and intensive as one category. We're going to go from $202 million in FY06 to providing $304 million in FY10, $100 million going into these categories. Now, why is that important? I think it's important because people have said we've underfunded intensive needs for a number of years, and so they've had to use regular instruction funds to support those. Well, with $100,000 or $100 million increase in this 5 years, clearly, you're freeing up some resources that can be reallocated back to the other categories, either regular instruction or additional special education services, vocational education. So I think it's important that we recognize that when the money goes out in the foundation program, it's one pot. We do have allocations within the system to get us to the revenue. But at the end of the day, it's one pot of money. The district determines how to spend that money.
Representative Wilson, then Book.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eddie, on this sheet right here, I don't see intensive needs listed. Is that because they're included somewhere along here, or they are not included on this at all?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that first sheet is the federal definition of children with disabilities. Intensive needs is a state of Alaska definition.
Okay. Can we have, or maybe it's included in here because I didn't look all the way, do we have a list of the intensive needs students like we do the rest of them?
No, through the chair, Representative Wilson, your intensive needs students are in that 17,600 students.
No, they're in here somewhere.
They're in there somewhere.
That's
what intensive needs refers to is levels of service. How much additional service do these children require over, and I know I'm going to get in trouble for this, but for a regular special education child? I mean, these intensive needs, and you, if you take a look at our manual, you'll see we're talking about levels of service, and they have to have, the students have to be receiving all these additional services before we categorize them as intensive needs.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that a lot of intensive needs students, or maybe they all do, I don't know, but is many of them have a one-to-one person with them. Is that one of the criteria? I don't remember. I mean, I don't know because I haven't read that.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that was one of the criteria, although the state board loosened that provision up a little bit. It's our intent that the in most cases, these children will require a one-to-one aid. And it's not that they need assistance just during the school day. They need assistance outside the school day. So even if you had a student that has, say, some behavioral problems at school, but at the end of the day, they go down here and they go to work at McDonald's, that's probably not an intensive needs child.
Yeah.
Okay?
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jeans, would you clarify that on page 2, the one that says prepared 2709, your total here, 300,304, that is included in the forward funding that we already have scheduled, that is in the budget, and that those numbers are included in what we're already looking at?
Through the chair, Representative Book, the 2010 appropriation is already sitting in the education fund. And the appropriation that we are asking for this session would fund 2011.
Okay, I just wanted to make that clear for some of the people that
Representative Book. Been
involved. Thank you.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eddie, would you, do we have, as policymakers, do we have any options as far as determining at what point it may be better to take care of intensive needs students in like through health and social services or through different programs? I mean, what kind of parameter, what are we, I've been told that, you know, sometimes it gets really tough on the classroom and wondering, you know, I've heard teachers wondering, you know, if the value, and I don't know, do we have options there? Is that the federal law that we're complying with or what?
Mr. Jeans.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, it's under federal law, and these children, regardless of how disabled they are, have a right to attend public schools. And that's where the rub comes.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Wilson.
I'm sorry, for this coming year, 2010, for our budget year, special need, is it 11 times or is it 9 times? What's for this coming one?
For fiscal year 10, it will be 11 times. And then for fiscal year 11, it will be 13 times. Mr. Chairman, I was hoping to answer, do a couple follow-ups at this point.
Sure. Let me make sure, is your presentation on intensive needs is done or not?
No, I got one more schedule
okay.
for you. It just happens to be intensive needs.
Okay,
and the next schedule, it's got the Roman numeral 7 at the top. Mr. Chairman, I believe it's a little one like this.
It's a little back. It's right here.
Okay.
And I think this question came from you, Mr. Chairman, was the movement of intensive needs students after the count.
And this is Roman numeral, what is it?
7, I believe.
7, okay.
If I remember my Roman numerals correct.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, you asked if we could provide you with the schedule of the number of students that are intensive needs that moved after the count period. So this shows you the number of students that moved in and out of districts across the state. This is pretty consistent in what I'm seeing from year to year. Somewhere around between 30 and 20 students on a statewide basis. But you can see that the overall numbers in this particular year, Anchorage picked up 4 more than they lost. In other years, I've seen where Anchorage ended up with 2 less. You know, so again, this is one of those that we hear a lot of people say, you know, what about the kids that come in after the count period? And when I look at the historical data, there's not a whole lot of movement here. Typically, when these parents with these types of children with disabilities, they get into a community, they're receiving services. They don't want to take the children out of that environment in the middle of the school year. So you're going to see very little movement on it.
Representative Boot.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. However, Mr. Jeans, on that point, when they do move, especially if they go into a situation where there isn't the preparation or the environment, isn't the cost, I don't know what the word would be, exorbitant? Especially to some of those, you know, communities that may not have the kinds of, that are not prepared for those particular issues.
Through the chair, Representative Book, as I look at this schedule, the next heaviest impacted district received one additional intensive needs child outside of Anchorage. And I believe that all of our districts are adequately funded to provide the resources and services needed for one additional intensive needs child during the year.
Thank you.
Representative Benjamin.
Thank you. Mr. Jeans, a couple of days ago we had a presentation, I think in concert with the Mental Health Trust Authority's presentation on Bring the Kids Home, and I can't quite remember who gave the presentation, but
Jeff Jesse.
No, I remember Jeff, but there was also, he brought a few people up with him, and but there was a slide that we had on the wall that had trauma, and it had you know, the various factors associated with trauma, domestic violence, neglect, physical abuse, substance abuse, and so forth. On this spreadsheet right here, is there a way that, as I look at the categories, I see under ED is emotional disturbance, and that's the one that I can maybe in my mind make a direct connection between trauma and this overall number of 17,662. But are there any other categories that would allow that you can sort of tie those two, trauma to this overall number here?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, it's my understanding that the majority of those children under the bring the kids home, mm-hmm. Fall under that category of emotionally disturbed. So that's where I would expect to find most of those students. And Mr. Chairman, if I may, you know, when you have presentations like you had the other day, you will hear people use the term intensive needs, intensive services. Those children don't necessarily qualify for intensive needs funding as defined by the Department of Education, but people like to use that term quite a bit. And so I just caution you, you know, when you do hear that term used, to try and separate it from what the people are trying to share with you as truly intensive needs or experiences that these children are going through versus intensive needs for funding purposes through the public school system. They, in many cases, they are not the same. But I'm not going to say in all cases.
Representative Wilson, then Gardner, and then Keller.
Oh, I was pointing at him. So.
Oh. Representative Gardner, then Keller.
Okay, and just to kind of support what Mr. Jeans is saying, those days, for example, some of the kids who are out of state are for eating disorders, and they may come back and they need wraparound services in the sense that bring the kids home intends it. But as far as their ability to learn, they may not be impacted at all. They might be very good students.
True. Yeah. Reverend Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you describe just the, like, I mean, I think an intensive needs student, it's pretty obvious that they're intensive needs students. But how do they, what is the process? An IEP, I mean, who's on that? I know that, you know, we have a team in that, but who is, how does it determine actually made? Like whether you keep a doctor with the student all the time, or a nurse, or I mean, how are those decisions made?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, all those decisions are made with the IEP team, what services are to be provided. And then when you get an opportunity to look at our training guide, you will see that there are specific services that we're looking for that a child is receiving. And when we're able to identify all of these services in the IEP, then that child's eligible for the additional funding. What we were trying to avoid for a number of years, which I finally had to give in, is telling people how to write an IEP to generate funding. But we got into so many disputes with school districts because this is the document that we rely on to determine eligibility for intensive funding. And so we actually wrote the document and says, when we say, for example, if you flip to page 7, one of the categories is that the child requires multiple services, including related services. And you can see we've given some examples. And we tell the districts, the special ed directors, the special ed people, exactly where we expect to find that information in the IEP. And we tell them exactly what we're looking for. So it shouldn't be a big surprise what documentation we're looking for to qualify a child for intensive.
Follow-up, Representative Keller.
Is there any mechanism at all to check on the accountability? It seems like there might be a tendency there. I mean, if you have an IEP team, obviously they are advocates for the child, I would hope. And do we balance that with?
Absolutely.
How?
I mean, yeah. Through the chair, Representative Keller, that's an excellent question. And that's exactly what our special ed team does when they go out and do field reviews. They have parent conferences where they invite parents to come in and talk to them about the services that their children are or are not receiving through the special education. They do checks to make sure that children are receiving the services that are identified in their IEPs. So that's part of the whole the federal compliance piece under the Disabilities Act.
Thank you. And Mr. Jeans, I think you identified earlier that you have a $150,000 increment for 3 auditors.
Correct.
For intensive need. Is
that for intensive needs only.
Right. Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, right now we are reviewing all the new claims for intensive funding because we have limited staff. Our intent is to do 100% review of the 2,000 or whatever the number is on an annual basis.
Good. Are there committee have any other questions? I think we've had a pretty good review of special needs and intensive needs. Anything further? Thank you very much, Mr. Jeans, for the
Thank
presentation.
You.
Before we go on, I want to just make sure that everyone in the public, as well as the committee and bill sponsors, understand that we're dealing with a number of subjects. One is early childhood education, and there's going to be multiple approaches to that. We've got House Bill 69 here. We have an increment in the current budget from the governor for providing services through through school systems, pilot project there. I'm sure that we will have other sources as well, and what we're doing is we're looking in detail and trying to get the firmest handle we can on each one of those mechanisms, and then we're going to be looking at the Education Committee determination of what we think is going to be the best policy for the state of Alaska to pursue for of how to get there. For I think there's a full recognition that we need more early childhood education so that students can achieve their maximum when they come into the K-12 system. However, the mechanism for getting there that will have results that will last, you know, through, don't just last till you get into kindergarten, but that also progress through and take kids through the third grade, the fourth grade, whatever. And so we want to look at results. We want to look at results-based. We want to look at data before we determine what's the best course for the committee to recommend for integrating and adopting, supporting early childhood development within the state. So my goal in having bills on those subjects up is not to bang the gavel and move the bill out. My goal there is to bring in and understand each one of those mechanisms for providing early childhood education, and so that the committee can come up with and find out what the committee feels is the best policy direction. So I want to make sure that everybody understands that we are not spearheading bills through the committee and we're done with the subject, because the subject has many ways of approaching it. And so that's we've gotten a lot of comments like vote against a certain bill or vote for a certain bill, and I think at this point in time what we're doing is we're using the bills, we're using the governor's increment, and we'll be getting a presentation on that mechanism of how that pilot project would be accomplished soon, so that we can look at this and figure out the policy. So I just wanted to make everybody aware, including the sponsors of different bills, that that's what we're doing at this point in time, and we'll make decisions soon, but not until we have been able to look and balance and weigh those different approaches for that. And the same, there's some loan programs, student loan programs, and there's multiple bills out there for loan programs. And so we heard from the Taylor Foundation on their approach. We have a bill that we're going to be hearing next meeting, I believe. And we're looking at those approaches and finding out what we want, how we want to proceed. So just so everybody's clear of where we are right now in the process. Does anybody have any questions on that? Representative Keller.
Oh, just a statement of appreciation. I mean, it really feels good to be on a policymaking committee that's taking it serious, looking at all the angles. So thank you.
Okay, very good. So we are going to then proceed on to our consideration of House Bill 69. And again, we have the sponsor with us. We have some materials that have been provided. We also have a list of people that had signed up. Was this the same deal? This is the list from last time? Yeah. That had signed up last time. We're going to continue through public testimony and presentations, and again I want to make sure that everybody understands what we're doing is trying to find out the dimensions and how each one of these work or would work for Alaska. And so that's where we're proceeding first. There are a couple things that you'll see that you've been given, one that has a memorandum from Representative Tuck office, and then on the next page we've got a fiscal note, and there were some questions about, you know, how is that generated? I asked the representative to look at, or his staff to look at programs, because this program, Parents as Teachers, is currently operating in Alaska in, I forget, 30 locations, and look at the usage in some of those communities where they have an open program. That's a program that, meaning that anyone that wants to volunteer can be in the program. And so we've looked at those rates, and Fairbanks is one of those that had a open program, and 4.4% of the families who would qualify are actually using the program. So we have a little better handle than saying every child in Alaska will take advantage of a voluntary program, because the voluntary program is available currently in a number of communities across the state, so that we can look at what is the voluntary usage of that program and get a better handle. If this was available in all the communities, what's reality and not just, you know, speculation. So whether people agree with that identification of potential usage, I think it gives us another mechanism for looking at it, and that's all that information is there for. But it's so with that, let's go to Nikki Shelton. Nikki, would you come forward and identify yourself and your affiliation, and then go ahead and give us your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Seaton and members of the committee. My name is Nikki Shelton. I have been a resident of Hoonah for 34 years. I've spent 22 years in the classroom, and then I was fortunate enough to be hired by Hoonah City Schools in 1995 as the first Parents as Teachers parent educator. At that time, there were no programs in Alaska, and so Hoonah City Schools had the first Parents as Teachers program. That's our bid to fame. I've been a Parents as Teachers parent educator, delivering services to families. I've also been the Parents as Teachers director, and I currently am a national trainer for the Parents as Teachers Center in St. Louis, Missouri. And we have developed to the point where we now have two Parents as Teachers national trainers who live in Alaska, and myself and Jen Carlson, who lives in Kenny Lake. So our first responsibility is to train and certify parent educators who will deliver Parents as Teachers services in Alaska. And the core of the Parents as Teachers program is the personal visit. And the personal visit occurs on a regular basis, and it is the frequency depends on the program, the needs of the families, the choices of the families. Where the program, or excuse me, where the visits occur is the choice of the parents. And in Hoonah, we currently have 70% of the parents choosing to do it in their homes. 30% are doing it at other locations. Sometimes it's the PAT center. The kids love to come there, so a lot of times the parents like to bring them there. We also have done them at the Head Start Center. When we had a Bromley Center, which was the child care center, we did them there when families came to pick up their kids. We also do them at other relatives' homes. Could be a grandparent's home or an aunt's house or wherever. But it's always the choice of the parent where those visits occur. And the components of the personal visit, in your packets that you received on Wednesday, there were samples from our curriculum. And I brought a curriculum with me, which is a huge tote. And before Parents as Teachers, parent educators can perform the duties or deliver any services, they have to be certified to use the materials. To get the desired results that the statistics show Parents as Teachers gets, the materials have to be used and the services delivered in the with fidelity to the design of the model. We do have flexibility, but the components of the program and the visit remain the same. Now, in the visit, it's a flow between the parents and the parent educator. Those attending the visit are determined by the family. Sometimes they want another caregiver to be there. We do visits where we have a person who provides child care while a parent works, and they would attend the visits, which is like the best of all worlds. Then we also have some where there might be a grandparent who is living with or very active in the child's care, and they may choose to participate. So the basic elements are the same, and the parent educators are taught to use the three volumes of visit plans as a guide, but the goals of the and the needs of the parents always come first. So that a visit, when I'm going into a family, a visit will look different with each one that I do in a week. So, and that's because when I come in, one of the first questions I'll ask is, what new things is Jamie doing since the last time we were here? Well, sometimes it will be, you know, things are going great. We've been doing the clothespins in the bottle activity that we made last time, and it's incredible how he just carries this bottle around and wants everybody to watch him do it. Other times it may be it's been a tough week or month that he just seems to be falling apart, and then that becomes a primary topic that would be discussed. As a parent educator, I've gone in with my guide and an idea that we're going to talk about brain development and how this activity of putting the clothespin in the bottle and getting larger and smaller instruments to put in there is teaching eyes and hand coordination and what parts of the brain it's developing. That might have been my primary focus, and we may talk about that. But we're also going to, it's an interaction between the family and the parent educator. We're also, the child is a really important part. We don't do visits without the child because we're constantly observing the child. The parent educator is pointing out how what the child is doing relates to the development of that child. They reinforce the strengths of the parents. Parents very often say, well, it didn't work when I did it later like it did when you were on the visit. And I would say, well, show me how you were doing it and talk about some options. We also have a parent-child activity that we bring to every visit. And this would be related to our discussion topics, but it also is geared to the child's interest. I had a boy who was totally fixated with vehicles, particularly yellow Tonka vehicles. And so I tried to find, I had the greatest collection of books about Tonka, you know, front end loaders and all sorts of stuff. And so if we were doing colors, I'd get as many trucks and vehicles as I could find. If we were talking about counting or making games, we'd use little trucks. The parent-child activity uses materials families have readily available. Which means reusing paper towel tubes and milk cartons and things that families are going to have around. So we show them that the home is a learning environment and they can use things there. The parent educator's role is to model for the parent how to do the activity and then they turn it over. So we are not the child's teacher. We are the coach for the parent. And then as we always talk about the rationale of why this is helpful to the child's development for the parent to do that. If we don't, and that we really stress that in training because if it's not important, we're just entertainment for an hour and that's it. Another component that is on every visit is book activity. So I always bring a book. Sometimes the parent educator models if it's a baby and the parent says, well, I didn't know you're supposed to read to you know, babies. They don't know language. They can't read. I would model what would be appropriate, and then the parent reads to the child. Sometimes the child says, I'm reading this book to you, Daddy, and they'll read it. But we always have literacy activities. With the preschool kids, the 3 to kindergarten entry kids, it's a more developed literacy experience. And we might be interacting, we might be doing our own. I went walking through the woods and see bears and eagles and that kind of thing. We also have a parent follow-up, so that at every visit, I have activities that I ask the family to do between now and the time that I come back. And it's reinforcing the development that we've observed and talked about, and then it gives a chance to, again, the parents are assuming the learning responsibility for their kids, and families really like it. And sometimes when I come back, we always ask, how did it go with the chips in the can? Sometimes it worked great. Sometimes they say, you know what, the 2 older kids fight over who's going to play the game with Sarah, so can we make another one? And we're great trash collectors, so that we can always have supplies to help parents do those. Now, in order to do these visits, parent educators, as the first step after being hired, have to become certified that they are not permitted to use the curriculum and do visits under the Parents as Teachers model until they receive training and certification, so that there's fidelity to the model, and so that we're certain that the philosophy that the parents are the first and most influential teachers, that they are the experts on the child, and we are the consultants who bring in resources and information and options, but it is the parents' choice of what they want to try out with their family. So the trainings are really important. We're lucky enough now that we do Alaska training several times a year, because it's a national program, but Parents as Teachers is a local, national model, but a local program. So that we stress in the Alaska trainings that when parent educators are gathering materials, purchasing books to start a new program, that we are making it look like the world that our kids live in. So the materials that I use in Huna are very different than what would be used in Kenny Lake, because we have a very strong Tlingit culture, and so that is very much built into the program that we have in Huna. And the villages up north have Athabascan built in. And so we do have a lot of individual flexibility within the programs, but that certification has to be the first step. And they receive that at the Born to Learn prenatal to 3 training. So that's step one. Step two, if they're delivering services for kids 3 to K, is to go to the 3 to K training. So those two are mandatory, and they have to be successful and become certified. They can repeat if that doesn't happen. Then professional development is required every year, so that skills are being built. This isn't you go to 7 days of training, you know it all, you're set for life. And in order to be recertified for the following year, parent educators must develop a professional development plan with their supervisors. And on the website, www.parentsasteachers.org, there's a link called PAT University, which lists all of the curriculum and formal trainings that are available. There are also web-based trainings that parent educators can take over the web, and they can also do the distance delivery classes through University of Alaska. They're excellent early childhood options that a lot of us who are outside of urban areas can take advantage. So it's an ongoing process, but the Parents as Teachers National Center and the Alaska PAT are very serious about being sure that parent educators are well prepared to deliver visits, that there's fidelity to the model, and that families needs and goals come first, and that's the way that we get the results that we talked about earlier in the week.
Great. I think that we all needed a little better understanding of what this program does and how it operates in the with the parents. Just a little question. You said about 70% of the visits are in the home and about the other 30 are in another place. What basic percentage participation do you have in HUNA on the program? And I guess I should ask, is the program like in Fairbanks where it's open for anyone, or have you got a limitation in HUNA?
Chair Seaton, at the current time, I don't have the statistics. I can say it's very high, which I know isn't precise. I will get those to the committee members. An interesting point that I can tell you, one of the huge results, which we're really proud of, is that after 14 years, we have weekly family nights, and the attendance is anywhere between 40 and 65 people, and this is in a town of 850. So it's very popular. I will get the exact numbers to you. We have, I won't even guess, but I will get them to you.
And in HUNA, has that reached a funding cap, or is that, is that open? It's a voluntary program, but is it open to everyone?
Yes. Chair Seaton, it is. The program is open to everyone. The only requirement is that a child be of the right age. We previously did have limits, and we had waiting lists, which was very unfortunate. We had kids who aged out of the program and never got services. We did include those families in monthly group meetings, but they didn't get visits. We fortunately have had extreme support from a lot of partners who have given us grant money, so that now we have enough parent educators that all families are eligible to participate, and they're busy.
And just one follow-up question. Do you work with the school district there in HUNA?
Currently, we are with the school district. That's the sponsoring program, although in the past, we did have other agencies who actually paid for parent educators. So at one time, we had three of us. We were all paid by different agencies, but we worked together in one program. Only we knew we worked for different agencies. And without that kind of support, we wouldn't be where we are now. But
currently, it's all through the school
district. It's all through the school district at the current time.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. I think we may as well just start going. We're just going to go around the table. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just clarified one thing. Your paycheck comes from HUNA City Schools, and I was wondering who in the school district, how did they, you said it was a national model and a local program. So the national model, I went online last night and I was fooling around with it, and I was given opportunity to donate to him, and that just got me thinking, trying to figure out the money flow. So did somebody in HUNA was innovative and went out and found this national model and applied for a grant through them? And is there any major foundations that initiated this? And who are, you mentioned partners, were you talking local partners? Are there national big names that put money in this?
Representative Keller through the chair, you want me to tell you all my secrets, don't you? it actually was an innovative person. We had a superintendent, which many of you probably know, John Antonin. And he went to a superintendent's conference in California, and he heard a presentation on parents as teachers. And he came back, and I was about to retire from teaching, and he said, "I found the perfect job for you." And I said, no, I'm not going to be one of those people with two careers. And he said, I don't know why we don't have this program in Alaska. It's crazy. We need it. And so he actually, we didn't have money then, but a couple years later then, they actually started up with Title I money, because it's listed in the authorization under several federal, so it's appropriate use for Title I money. So we used Title I money to start, just little itty-bitty program. And then the HUNA Heritage gave us money. Tlingit and Haida Central Council was immensely, they actually paid for one position. We actually had the infant learning program wrote a grant, which helped. We also had the Ward's Cove Packing Company gave us money for the first few years. And then we started applying for the Senator Stevens Alaska Native Education Equity grant money. And that's what we're funded on now. Oh, we've also been funded through the Children's Alaska Children's Trust. So it's kind of like wherever you can find money. And the majority of the programs in Alaska right now do receive their money through the Senator Stevens Grant Fund.
Thank you very much. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Have you been able to track the success of the students, some of the students that have participated in the program through as they go through the high school process?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I wish I could say that we had been enlightened enough that when we started, we did it as a study. Parents as teachers did. When they started in 1984, it was only first-time parents with one child. And so they have all the statistics. We didn't do that. We are lucky that we have anecdotal, because I know who the, well, everybody who was in that first group of 13 families knows who participated, and they see who gets the awards. And a few years ago when we did an elementary awards assembly, and a dad of a third grader came up to me afterwards, and he said, I just observed the most amazing thing. He said, I had a revelation. And I, well, what was it? And he said, all those kids in my son's third grade class who were up there getting awards were in parents as teachers with us. And the kids in the class who weren't in the, because they weren't able to get in, who weren't in parents as teachers, were not up there getting awards. And I hadn't noticed it, which I guess I should have, but it's a small community, and it just didn't register. But from then on, we, the teachers knew which kids, now most of the kids are, but we don't have any statistics. It's only anecdotal, but the vast majority of the parents, the most common comment is, I wish I had had this with my older kids because they wouldn't have struggled in school so much. So it's all anecdotal. We're going to try to put together some of those and get them to you, but we don't have statistics. I'm sorry.
Representative Wilson, Representative Edgman, do you have any questions on this point
in
operation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So are we to imply from your testimony then that House Bill 69 basically is not needed?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, it is needed because the funding for the programs that we have right now is extremely unstable. So that we have lost a couple of really good parent educators because we were almost to the end of our grant. We didn't know if we were going to get funding. The school district certainly didn't have money to support us at this time completely. And so the instability of the funding is a huge problem. And then we also have areas that do not have any services for kids under school age. They don't have Head Start or home visiting services. So yes, it is very much a needed program. Both for places that don't have services and also because of the funding is just so unstable.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just
follow up, Representative Edgman.
I'll just limit my questions here and ask one more question. There's a definition of family in the bill, and I noticed you or heard you use the word parents, and so are those two terms sort of interchangeable as described in House Bill 69 and in your reference to parents with your experiences in Nahuna?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, thank you for asking that question. I shouldn't have been using parents all the time because visits are done with a lot of different family configurations. We have foster parents who participate with the kids. We have grandparents who participate. Whoever is the child's caregiver or whoever who has responsibility for that child decides who does the visits. So it can be one parent, it can be two parents, it can be an aunt, it can be a grandmother, it could be a foster parent, it could be adoptive parent. So the actual family configuration varies quite a bit.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner, do you have any questions?
Thank you, no.
Okay. Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you being one like some of us in this room, in these arenas where we are second career people. Thank you for your expertise. Thank you for taking all of that and you know, reapplying it to a whole nother studies, actually. In looking at your experiences and your expertise, your communications with the rest of the parent teachers around the state, how comprehensive are we to your knowledge? You were the first one. Mm-hmm. And how has it grown, and what have you seen in your particular experiences?
It has grown incredibly, and there aren't very many opportunities where all of the parent, well, there are no opportunities where all the parent educators get together, but we through the LASCA PAT, we do have teleconferences where we can communicate. And I can say that I actually get chills sometimes when I hear parent educators who were in trainings in 2001, and some of them, one lady comes to mind who delivers services in UPIC, and she was talking in August at an in-service training that I attended of theirs, and her depth of knowledge was absolutely astounding. And it's not unusual, because parent educators are very passionate about what they do, and so they continue to grow and develop, and we have this cadre across the state of these very unsung heroes who are doing this work with families, and it's really inspirational to me, because it's just amazing. And when one of the things we talk about in training is that each child only gets one shot at childhood, and when I think of what these people are doing that alters the courses of kids' childhood, and families are so happy with it, it's inspirational to me. So yes, I always wish that we had more places where kids have it, but I'm really pleased with what I see around the state. It's really amazing.
Follow up, Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you briefly go over some of what you're seeing as far as the advancements in the continuing education that's available now since you started?
Representative Booth, through the chair, are you referring to the parent educators?
Yes, as to what you see as far as your continuing education since 1994 as your involvement.
Okay. Many of the parent educators have, as their first step, they get their child development associate, which is a credential. That would be the first step. And I don't have the statistics on how many have them, but the majority of them are working on them. Then they take distance delivery classes and get AAs. We have several who have earned their bachelor's in early childhood. So it actually has become a career. And maybe in a few years we'll have some statistics about how many parent educators have gone on. But that's another thing that is heartwarming to me, is that people who are in very small places have been hired as a parent educator and have developed it into a career where they're delivering services and taking the college coursework through the distance delivery system and developing professionally that way. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Nikki. We sure appreciate that. And we took more time than normal because, you know, we've been talking about a program, and we wanted to find out exactly how it's conducted, and so appreciate
Thank
that.
Thank you, Chair Seaton.
Jane Sullivan.
Hi.
Good morning. Would you identify yourself on the record and go ahead?
Hi, I'm Jane Sullivan. I have a degree in early childhood education, and I have homeschooled my 5 children. And also, I have been a PAT, parent educator, in Hoonah, and I've also worked for Head Start for a number of years. I'll give you a little bit of history about my homeschooling experience. My husband and I decided to homeschool our children because we wanted to provide the best educational opportunities for them. We wanted to address their individual learning styles, their interests in different subjects, and our learning goals for each child. Homeschooling was not easy. It required a lot of discipline for my children and for me as their teacher, organization, and a willingness for me to understand that I could not do that alone. I utilized all the local school resources I could. My older children took auto shop classes. We attended writing workshops. We were involved in science fairs. We used the school library weekly, and we also depended on the school for course materials, curriculum material. I participated in state and federal testing for my kids on an annual basis because I wanted to verify that I was teaching them appropriately and they were at least at or above their grade levels. When I started working for Parents as Teachers, I realized that Parents as Teachers was actually an extension of that same dynamic as a parent homeschool teacher. Because Parents as Teachers encourage parents to realize that they were their child's first teacher, that they could see themselves as being vital and important in the development of their child and in their child's learning. Parents want their children to learn. They want them to understand. They want to understand how their child develops. They want to know if their child is bonding to them appropriately, if their child's crying too much, if they're crawling at the right time, if they're walking or even holding an object correctly. These are all things that parent educators address. Educating parents about what's happening to their kids, what to expect next from their kids, and how to respond to things their kids need, and also where to find resources for their children are all things that parent educators do. We are facilitators that help parents understand that they have an incredible impact and they receive joy and pride from their experiences as parents. The parents I worked with in Hoonah came to understand and be excited about the positive influence that they could have on their children's lives.
Thank you. Do we have questions? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Do we have your testimony in written form in
No.
all the packets?
And it's very messy. But I can make that available.
Okay. The people who have, through the chair, who have been writing to us, by and large, are opposed to this. I mean, that's the experience I've had most of the letters. And I think that many of them are homeschoolers and they're worried about government intrusion with their families. And, you know, we can understand that concern that people have. But what I want to do, and I've already talked to Nikki about it a little bit, is respond to them and send some of the letters of support so they can see that the people who've actually been involved with the program have a different point of view and don't find it intrusive. And I think if you could send us, and it doesn't have to be a long or really involved mm-hmm. letter, but your own experience, I think, mm-hmm. might be interesting to some of the people who are so worried about mm-hmm. it. And I mean, I myself was very concerned about it at first blush, too. I didn't realize it had already been here 14 years and is in 45 communities, mm-hmm. 47, whatever. I guess the number fluctuates a little bit. But so if we could get something just... Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be really long and involved.
Thank you. We'd appreciate that, Jane. If you just get that to the committee, we'll make sure this gets distributed. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Let's go to, let's see, we had Melissa Pickle had given us the presentation the other day. She's here. That was the PowerPoint presentation. Do committee members have questions? Representative Book.
Not for her.
Okay.
Well,
we appreciated the PowerPoint, and but I wanted to make sure since you were available that if the committee did have a question,
well,
Representative Benjamin.
Yes, she's in the audience. She looks like she's willing to come up, so maybe we can just hear some very quick testimony.
And Representative Benjamin, we do have her PowerPoint that was the one that was presented when somebody else had to turn her slides. Welcome. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Good morning. I'm Melissa Pickle. I just wanted to let you know that I am here if you have any questions, and that I will be here all day, and I'd be more than willing to set aside time to meet with each of your offices. And also, my supervisor recommended that I actually give you a little bit of my credentials so that you knew kind of my background, and I'll take just a moment to do that. I have a bachelor's in psychology. I have a master's in early childhood special education. I have been in the field of early childhood and working with young children and families for more than 15 years. 10 of those have been in the state of Alaska. I have worked for Head Start, Early Head Start. I've been a home visitor for Head Start and Early Head Start. I've been a classroom teacher. I've worked as an early interventionist with the programs for infants and children. And I also worked with the Upiat School District as their early childhood program coordinator out in Akyetchuk and Akyak and Tuluksek. So my experience within the state and working with all of the Parents as Teachers programs in our state has really ranged in communities, basically from Ketchikan all the way up to Savoonga. So,
well, and Melissa, would you give us your current position?
I am the Parents as Teachers Alaska State Coordinator, and I work for Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Okay, and that's Rural CAP as we generally know it.
Yep.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I asked a previous testifier, Nikki Shelton, about whether she supported the bill or not. And I gather you support the bill?
Yes, I do. And Nikki spoke to the programs kind of coming and going, and because of unstable funding. And actually, since 1999, we have had 10 separate Parents as Teachers programs in Alaska that lost funding, that are no longer functioning because they were funded through federal grants that either are no longer in existence or they're no longer, they weren't refunded through those grants. It had nothing to do with whether or not they were successful. These were all very successful programs. And so that's what we're dealing with, is every year it changes from how many programs we have from year to year because of these different funding sources. They're all federal grants, so.
Was there another question? Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on a scale of 1 to 10, in your opinion, how would you rate this?
Well, through the chair, Representative Book, I certainly would rate this as a 9 to 10. This is really, we know that early childhood, investing in early childhood is critical. And what is not always heard is the numbers that are quoted from the various research that has been done, like the Perry Preschool Project, the Chicago Schools, all of those kind of gold standard research programs that talk about the importance of early childhood. All of them had very, very strong parent, you know, personal visit components to them. They were not just center-based. And I think that that's really important, is that we want to have options for families, and that this should be something that is available. We know that not every community is going to have a Head Start. Not every community will have a preschool four-year-old program. This is an option that certainly could be made available in those smaller communities that can't support those, or for children who are younger than 4 years of age. This program works well for children birth all the way up to 5. So that means that those children could be receiving services birth to 3 before they ever enter into Head Start or into a preschool program.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Melissa. And we'll point out again that Melissa, the PowerPoint presentation we had, was Melissa on the phone. So, and Melissa, if you wouldn't mind waiting around afterwards in case any of the individual members want to have get individual meeting times.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Are we going past at 10 a.m.?
No, we are going, I wanted to check one thing. Faye Gallagher, are you here? We have one other person in the room. Everybody else is online, so we'll just have to have them later. But I would like to take Faye because she's here from HUNA. So, Faye, would you come up? And I apologize for the committee for going over 10 o'clock, but.
Hello, I'm Kim Huna. My name is Peg Gallagher. And I first wanted to state that it was nice this morning to see a couple of you kind of forget what you were going to say for a moment, because the other day when I did that, I just froze up. And I was just like, oh, my God, I know what I want to say, and I couldn't remember. But anyway, I just wanted to let you know that I am a grandparent of a four-year-old girl. And I worked at the school district in the main office for 10 years from 95. 95 is when the program started. And I didn't really know much about parents as teachers. They were downstairs, and I worked in the office. And the only thing I knew about them really was that I delivered their paycheck to them. And so when my granddaughter was born in 2005, they invited me and my daughter to participate in the program. And at first I'm thinking, well, you know, what can you teach a little infant in a classroom or whatever, you know? And so I wasn't too familiar with it. But it's a great program, and I can't think of the word I want to use. I support it 100%, because for one thing, I'm disabled. And so I was caring for my granddaughter for 3.5 years. And when I was invited to come down, I don't drive, I don't have a car, or even know how to drive. And I was trying to figure out how to get down there every day, because when I wasn't disabled, I walked all the time. And so one of the things that they did was they provided transportation for me to come down there. And I thought that was really great, because I don't think I would have gone. And the materials that they give you are just, it's really good, especially, like, I want to say, talking not only for myself as a grandparent, but as young people. There's a lot of young people that have children. And a lot of times they don't know. There's no parenting classes in Huna. You come down to this Parents as Teachers, and they actually teach you how to care for your child and to bond with your child. And there's a lot of things that you wouldn't realize that you can teach an infant, and they give you all these ideas. And my granddaughter just flourished, I guess is a word you want to say. She just did great, and if I hadn't gone to the program, I wouldn't have known some of the tools to use to interact with her more. I mean, maybe she would have been sitting in front of the TV a lot of the time, you know, instead of having one-on-one with grandma or mom and reading to her a lot and doing the shapes, the colors. They provide books for you to share with your child, and they also, you get mail outs with books every month. You get a book in the mail, so your child gets mail. My granddaughter, sometimes I'd have to read up to 10 books before she'd go to sleep at night, because she just loved to read. And then we'd sing. And so, I mean, she's very good at a lot of things that I think grandma had a lot to do with some of it, but parents as teachers gave me those tools to work with. And the one thing that I do want to state is that my granddaughter's other grandparents live in Wasilla, and they hadn't seen her since she was 5 months old. And because of a death in the family, I had to take her up there in 2007. So they hadn't seen her for 2.5 years. And we didn't have much communication. And when her grandpa saw her, and she was just talking a mile a minute and just very advanced, he said, "You've done a great job with her. I'm just so proud," because he hadn't seen her. And I just feel that the Parents of Teacher program gave me a lot to work with her, and I think that it's real important for parents to be able to do that with their children. I was just on our way in today, we were talking about how they don't have a program here in Juneau, and they were just, I mean, Huna's really small, and there's a lot of single parents there or young parents that could use these opportunities to help their children and themselves so that they know, well, so that they can have a better life for their children. And like, when my children were small, there was Head Start. There wasn't a preschool or anything like that. And so you had to wait for them to be 3 or 4 years old, and then you had to be under income in order to even be eligible. Well, this program, you know, it's for everybody. But I'm not sure what else I wanted to say about it, but it's just, it's really a great program. Oh, I was going to say, here in Juneau, if they could get it going here, I think it would be wonderful, because I see, I've been over here for medical reasons for like 5 months, and I see a lot of young parents and that would be able to benefit from this with their children. And it really helps with like a bonding issue too. If you pay more attention to your children, maybe they'll grow up to be productive citizens in society. And I mean, it can't hurt, you know, so. Anyway, I think I did pretty good saying what I wanted to say today, but thank you for hearing me, and I hope the bill passes and the funding goes through, and that's about all I have to say right now.
Well, we appreciate it, Faye. I know it's difficult, and you did a great job coming
all
in.
All right. Thank you very much.
If there aren't any pressing questions, people may want to talk to you afterwards, but we are over time, and people have other meetings, so appreciate it. And we will be taking other public testimony and other information on this program, as well as other early childhood programs in the near future. And on Monday, we're going to have explanation of No Child Left Behind.
Mr. Chairman, before we leave this bill, before we leave this topic, and these people in this room, can we put it on the schedule for this bill?
I'm not prepared to do that right now. We'll continue taking public testimony as we fit it into our overviews and go forward that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So we will be adjourned at 10:10.